Greetings, and welcome to CatastropheCast. My name is Walter, and today we're actually going to talk about the fifth largest conventional explosion by magnitude, with an estimated 2.7 to 3.2 kilotons of TNT in firepower. Now, this incident is considered the worst industrial accident in American history. It is an explosion that was caused by ammonium nitrate, which, if you're familiar with, is primarily a fertilizer, but it's also used in a myriad of other things. Even the cheap airbags in cars was made with ammonium nitrate. And you may think of the Oklahoma City bombing, and yes, that actually was done with ammonium nitrate, but it was also in conjunction with fuel oil. What I'm actually speaking of is the Texas City catastrophe of April 16th, 1947. Now, before we get into it, there's actually another incident in Texas City called the Texas City Refinery Explosion. That's from 2005. This incident that we're talking about today is actually much worse in the scale and scope of loss of life and loss of property. So a little bit about Texas City. It is a town that was founded by ranchers in the 1800s, and it sits on the Texas coast around 40 miles south of Houston. Now, and if you think about the timeline, this is 1947. Immediately after World War II, when we're trying to help Europe rebuild to come out of the war and all of the damage that was done during the war. So there was a giant boom in terms of buildings and raw materials that were going to go to Europe. Texas City itself had a population of around just under 6,000, so about 5,700 people in 1940. That was according to the United States Census. But because of the booming economy and the jobs that were plentiful there, and not just jobs, but well-paying jobs that were there, the city almost swelled by three times. So there was about 16,000 people in 1947. Texas City was host to two chemical plants, and it also had three large oil refineries, just to name a few of the big businesses that were in town. And also, last little bit of background, when you think of the 1940s, life in America up until the jet age, everything was done by transport. And that transport, of course, was train. So you've got a lot of stuff moving through trains into port cities. Those ports have ships that will take all those raw materials over to Europe or wherever they're needed in the world to help rebuild. The story of the actual catastrophe started about 5 years previous during World War II, and that was a ship that was christened in 1942 as the SS Benjamin Curtis. That ship, after the war, it served in the Pacific Theater, and after the war, the U.S. government actually offered the ship to France to aid in World War II restoration. So because of the war, as I mentioned, parts of Europe were just in desolate ruin, and they needed as much supplies as they could get to help rebuild. The U.S. offered different materials to help rebuild, and of course, corporations, being corporations, were quite happy with selling anything and everything, including fertilizers. War or not, you actually have to feed people, so you have to have fields and you have to have fertilizer to put in those fields to help the plants grow. So one of the big things to ship to Europe during this time was fertilizers. The French actually took the ship and renamed it the SS Grand Camp, and that ship made runs between Europe and the United States Central America, with goods that Europe was still able to export, and then goods that the Americas and Central America could actually give back to Europe to help rebuild. On the morning of April 11th, 1947, the Grand Camp was docked at Texas City. Now you'll note this is 5 days previous. It had arrived from Europe having picked up 16 cases of ammunition in wooden boxes, and it had also made stops in Cuba and Houston to pick up things like peanuts and baling wire. The reason for showing up in Texas City was to pick up its load of ammonium nitrate fertilizer. The fertilizer was going to take a couple of days to load. There was quite a bit of it. And over the next few days, they had gotten about 2,300 tons into two different cargo holds. So by the morning of the April 16th, the rain had slowed them down, but they had still managed to get quite a lot of ammonium nitrate fertilizer onto the ship. When the workers entered the ship around 8 a.m. that morning, that was the first inkling that there was something wrong. The workers themselves smelled smoke, so of course they reported it. When people went to investigate, they actually found a small fire in a hold near the hull of the ship. And at 8:25, the alarm was sounded. Now, Texas City itself had a volunteer fire department, and it had four fire trucks to support the fire department. All four of them showed up to the ship, and they all tried to help put the fire out. The fertilizer itself was in holds 2 and 4, and the ammunition that I mentioned before, that was in hold 5, which was, of course, next to the fire in hold 4. The only thing that separated the ammunition from the fire in the next hold was a piece of steel about a quarter inch thick. The workers evacuated from hold 4, where they were loading the ammonium nitrate, and they were actually asked to remove the munitions from the next hold over, hold 5. Now, these 16 boxes of munitions actually weighed about 150 pounds apiece, so the workers only managed to get out 3 boxes before they were told, hey, this is getting dangerous, you need to evacuate. And at the same time as the workers were evacuated, the entire ship was evacuated due to the possibility of explosion. Now, in an effort to put out the fire, but at the same time save the cargo, the captain ordered what it was actually quite common in the day. He ordered the holds to be steamed. And normally, this would put out any fire in there. So if you've got a bunch of furniture on fire, if you've got, you know, different things that are on fire, not chemicals, but other things that are on fire, steaming it would actually go ahead and put the fire out. But in this case, the steam actually hurt their chances of putting out the fire. I am not a chemist by any means, but as I understand it, ammonium nitrate, when you burn it, when you heat it up, it actually converts to nitrous oxide, which is a laughing gas, with a byproduct of producing its own oxygen. Of course, a fire needs oxygen to continue to burn. And so since ammonium nitrate was building its own oxygen supply, actually steaming this to try and put it out did absolutely no good. Probably did more harm than good. So, like I said, instead of starving the fire of oxygen, the steam helped make more oxygen, and that just helped the fire grow and the heat grow. What's worse that the steam did was that it actually blew open the hatches. Now, when the hatches blew, that's when the spectators started lining up along the docks. Fires on the docks were not uncommon in the day because, of course, back then it was not as safe as it is now, some could say. So people would just show up to expect to see a show. And a discarded cigarette actually started a fire on the dock just 2 days previous. So fires on the dock were not uncommon at all. What's worse is the burning chemicals created billows of yellow and orange and golden smoke, which one person described as quite beautiful. And like any big scene, if you've ever been caught in traffic next to an accident, there are looky-loos. In any big scene, people just have to stop and watch. And they thought they were safe. They figured they were far enough away from the ship, they'd be fine. Of course, they weren't. At 9:12, that's when the first blast happened. So the heat buildup in the holds were massive. And, of course, so was the pressure inside the non-blown hatches. The entire vessel basically exploded in one giant explosion. And it created a wave that was 15 foot high that actually flooded the surrounding area. There were thousands of buildings on land that were just gone when the ship exploded. They were completely leveled. One of the city's chemical plants was completely destroyed, and the refineries and the chemical tanks that were on the waterfront to help ship oil out, ship chemicals out, those all went up in smoke as well. Other cargo, like bales of wire and the peanuts and the oil, that was sent out in the explosion. Even the ship's anchor was airborne, and that was found over a mile away. As I understood it, the anchor itself weighed over a ton, so you can imagine the kind of force that caused that. The explosion had a force so bad that windows in houses 40 miles away up in Houston were shattered, and people in Louisiana, which was 250 miles away, actually felt the blast. It was so powerful that even two low-flying aircraft were blown out of the sky. Their wings were sheared off. And a barge that was anchored at the port near the ship, the Grand Camp, was actually picked up and thrown 100 feet onto the shore into some buildings. So what happened? If you've listened to the Hartford Circus Fire of 1944 podcast, that's podcast number 15, it's actually unknown exactly what started the fire. Investigators say it was most likely a cigarette that was discarded improperly. You know, people knew that ammonium nitrate was explosive, but not everybody was careful. Not everybody pays attention to non-smoking signs. I don't even know if non-smoking signs existed back in 1947. But you have people who are careless in thought, so therefore careless in action. And that's exactly what most likely started this horrendous, horrendous catastrophe. The aftermath of the explosion was, some people could argue, even worse. So at the time, the city's telephone operators were on strike. But as soon as the explosion happened, they, of course, all went back to work. The thing is, it still delayed recovery efforts. If you've got a delay in getting information out, you're going to have a delay getting help in. So that was one bad thing right there. Texas City itself had a volunteer firefighting system. They didn't have an official one. So they had a 29-member volunteer firefighter system with, like I said, four engines. All but one of those firefighters was killed in the initial explosion. And of course, their equipment was destroyed. Texas City itself had no hospital. The people that did survive actually were sent away to Galveston or Houston, hospitals that were miles and miles away. City Hall itself and the Chamber of Commerce were really quickly converted over into triage shelters to help those people that were not the worst of it, that didn't have to be sent away. So people could go there for care and then possibly be transported out. Now, the Grand Camp itself was not the only ship carrying ammonium nitrate. There was another ship called the High Flyer, and when the Grand Camp exploded, the High Flyer was totally knocked about along with everything else in the port, and it caught fire. In the aftermath of the explosion, the High Flyer actually got tangled up with another ship called the Wilson V. Keene. And people knew, okay, that ship also has ammonium nitrate on it. We're going to try to do something to keep it from exploding. Now, unlike the first explosion, the responders knew that the High Flyer was most likely going to explode because of the fire. And they could not, even though they attempted to, they could not put the fire out on the High Flyer. So the decision was to try and move it away. So they got a bunch of people in a tug and tried to tow away the High Flyer further from shore. But because of how it was tied up with the Wilson V. Keene, it couldn't be done. So the crew was basically told, okay, back off, let's not do this. And about 15 hours after the Grand Camp exploded, around 1 o'clock in the morning, the High Flyer's cargo of ammonium nitrate exploded, and it destroyed that ship along with the SS William B. Keene. One of the propellers of the High Flyer was actually ripped off in the explosion, and it flew through the air almost a mile away. A lot of what was left of the docks was actually destroyed. Unlike the initial blast, this blast only took 2 additional lives. Now, in the end, the death toll will never truly be known from these catastrophes because there were, well, a myriad of reasons. There were 405 bodies that were actually identified. 63 bodies were not able to be identified at all. And then an additional 113 people were classified as missing. What's even worse, though, is the Monsanto factory. That was the factory that was destroyed in the initial blast. When that factory was demolished, it also demolished the personnel records. So there was actually no way to figure out who was there on the payroll, who was working that day, and may also be missing. There were also countless other victims that were killed and never counted. And that's because the port, like other ports, there were visiting seamen in the port, there were day laborers, and sometimes the day laborers' families. So it's really, truly unknown exactly how many people were on the port and were actually killed in the blasts. With all the bodies that they had to deal with, the high school gym was converted into a makeshift morgue, and a local garage was pushed into service as an embalming station. The imagery of that, to me, is probably the takeaway from this entire podcast. You've got, you know, something that is there to service cars, and instead of servicing cars, it's servicing human beings. A local dental school was able to pull its students in, and the students, along with other dentists, went into work and identifying the remains from dental records that were still available. And all this work continued for 2 more months until June 1947. Texas City held 3 mass funerals. April 19th, so that's 3 days post-catastrophe, was the funeral for the 405 people that were identified. On May 30th, the 28 firemen who lost their lives, there was a ceremony for them. And finally, on June 22nd, for the 63 people who remained unknown in death, they were buried. Much like other catastrophes, there was a silver lining in that good things came out of it, which again is kind of a hard thing to say, but there are good things that can come out of these things. There were new standards put forth for the transportation and dispersal of ammonium nitrate. The chemical was ordered to be stored in cooler temperatures. It was prohibited to be stored near any other reactive materials. So it couldn't be in hold 4 while there was ammunition in hold 5. And the long distance travel was highly discouraged of ammonium nitrate, and the overseas shipment was restricted. So that itself was really, really, really good. It also helped create a centrally coordinated emergency response effort, which actually grew outside of Texas City. So within a short time, the industrial mutual aid system was put together in Texas City, and they decided that if there is another disaster of some sort, we need to be able to coordinate our efforts to save people. The good thing is this mutual aid system was actually, as I said, it went statewide. Refineries across Texas followed suit. And interesting enough, I'd like to do a follow-up on this, on the Texas City refinery explosion, to see that industrial mutual aid system, if it was still in use, and if it was used during the Texas City refinery explosion of 2005. So that's it. The April 16th, 1947 Texas City catastrophe. I would like to thank you for listening. Please do not hesitate to go over to catastrophecast.com. There is the link for What Do You Want to Hear? I'm always taking suggestions. This podcast came from a suggestion, and I will do others. So if you have a request, put it in there. If you want to email me directly, you can email me at podcast@catastrophecast.com. We have a Facebook page, and we were over on Twitter. So connect up however you want and talk to us. That's it. Thanks for listening.